Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway, and this edition is published in the early hours of Friday the 12th of June. Our main stories: America's top general apologises for appearing alongside President Trump at a church photo op during the anti-racism protests. Mr. Trump has meanwhile authorised sanctions against international criminal court officials investigating possible US war crimes. Also in the podcast, Nigeria's state governors have declared a state of emergency to combat rape. And players hold a minute's silence for the victims of COVID-19 as top-flight professional football resumes in Spain. A week after George Floyd died under the knee of a policeman in Minneapolis, President Trump was photographed outside a church near the White House holding up a Bible. The route had been aggressively cleared of protesters by the police. Walking alongside the president was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, in full combat uniform. He now says that was wrong.
As many of you saw, the result of the photograph of me at Lafayette Square last week, that sparked a national debate about the role of the military in civil society. I should not have been there. My presence in that moment and in that environment created a perception of the military involved in domestic politics.
General Milley joins a number of current and former military leaders who have distanced themselves from President Trump's threat to use troops to end the unrest. His comments came as the president weighed in on the debate about the legacy of slavery in America and the Confederate leaders who fought to preserve it. After two statues were pulled down, President Trump tweeted that those who deny their history are doomed to repeat it. I spoke to our correspondent Gary O'Donoghue in Washington and asked him first how damaging are the comments from General Milley.
I don't think you would choose to have the chairman of the Joint Chiefs effectively criticising his own involvement in a presidential photo opportunity. And that's essentially what General Milley is doing here. He's saying he shouldn't have been involved. And, of course, we've already had Mark Esper, the Secretary of Defence, saying something similar because he was there too for that photo opportunity outside St. John's Church. But there's a wider thing beyond the wisdom of this or that photo opportunity, which is this tension that's been in place now for a couple of weeks between the Pentagon, the military in general, and the president, who wanted to and believed he could use the military, the general military, not just the National Guard, but the general military, to put down these protests.
Yeah, I mean, traditionally, Republicans and indeed all Americans are keen on the separation of powers. How will President Trump react to this?
It's really visceral, this separation. It goes right back to the founding of the Republic. In fact, there are a lot of people around at the founding of the Republic who didn't want a full-scale military because they feared it would be used against them internally. So this thing is really, really central to the sort of American psyche. The president won't like it. We haven't heard from him so far on specifically on General Milley's comments, but he believes that the military is something he's strong on. He's strong on it with his base, and he won't like this kind of dissent. We'll see what happens. When Mark Esper expressed some concern about the president's wish to use, the Insurrection Act to bring the military onto the streets, he almost fired Mark Esper last week. And indeed, Mark Esper also almost resigned, and they stepped back from that brink. But here he's got his most senior soldier in the country, effectively criticising what was happening.
And is his intervention about the pulling down of those statues, is that playing to his base as well?
Yeah, to some extent. I mean, bear in mind, he's pretty solid in the South. There are a bunch of states down there that regularly vote Republican. They probably won't vote any other way. So it's interesting to see how much that really matters, apart from sort of galvanising his support. But it equally will annoy a lot of other people in the North.
Gary O'Donoghue in Washington. The US has never accepted the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court, but that hasn't stopped President Trump taking action against court officials investigating possible American war crimes. He's authorised sanctions against them and their families. I heard more about the row from Anna Holligan in The Hague, where the ICC is based.
Well, it started a few years ago. So the ICC prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda, carried out something called a preliminary examination and found a reasonable amount of evidence to suggest that between 2003 right up to 2014, atrocities had been committed, including alleged mass killings of civilians by the Taliban, plus the alleged torture of prisoners by the Afghan authorities and by US forces and the CIA, so the Central Intelligence Agency in Afghanistan, and at US black sites, so rendition locations in Poland, Romania and Lithuania. That's the short version. And then in March this year, the ICC judges agreed there was enough evidence to go ahead with a full-blown investigation. So that's basically what this is about.
Yeah, the US deeply unhappy about this. What will these sanctions mean? How will they affect the court's actions?
This executive order will allow the administration to block the assets in the United States of ICC employees involved in this investigation. Also, it authorizes the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, to block these individuals' entry into the United States, and that also could extend to their families. And this goes beyond the kind of symbolic rhetoric we've seen and heard in the past, aside from the fact that presumably the investigators would want to travel to the US to speak to witnesses, gather evidence and that kind of thing. And you get an impression of the kind of way this has been received from some of the responses. Human rights groups have described the action as a blatant attempt at obstruction of justice, an outrageous act that targets individuals for doing nothing more than pursuing justice for victims, and to use financial sanctions as a weapon against those seeking to establish the truth is an outrageous abuse of power. That was from the International Federation for Human Rights. Although we should definitely point out at this point, there is no guarantee that any investigation would result in charges against anyone, much less an alleged CIA, in inverted commas, torturer. So it's definitely preemptive action, and it shows President Trump isn't willing to take any chances on this.
Anna Holligan in The Hague. The government of Zimbabwe has taken the unusual step of denying rumours of a coup plot. But President Emmerson Mnangagwa did warn of a conspiracy organised by hostile foreign governments to stir up unrest. It's 3 years since the military in Zimbabwe forced Robert Mugabe out of power, and the country faces a deepening economic crisis. Our Africa correspondent Andrew Harding reports.
As Zimbabwe sinks deeper into economic chaos, its government is lashing out. In a furious outburst, President Emmerson Mnangagwa spoke of an orchestrated campaign by hostile but unnamed foreign governments and local vigilantes. He said their aim was to make the country ungovernable. The Home Affairs Minister then raised the temperature further by going on television to dismiss rumours of an imminent coup attempt. Kazembe Kazembe blamed merchants of discord.
Claims of a military coup amount to mere agenda setting by merchants of discord amongst our people with the support of their foreign handlers. They are completely unfounded. For the avoidance of doubt, there's no coup in the making.
But doubt remains. After all, it's only 3 years since the military last intervened to push out Robert Mugabe, and Zimbabwe is arguably in a much more fragile state today. 8.5 million people, half the population, are struggling to feed themselves. Inflation is soaring and the authorities are cracking down hard on dissent. Three women, all opposition politicians, who said they'd been abducted and tortured, were arrested this week, accused of lying about their ordeal.
Andrew Harding. When much of the world went into lockdown in March, surrogate babies born in Ukraine became trapped, with their would-be parents unable to pick them up. Ukraine is one of the few countries where surrogacy is legal. Last month, officials said more than 100 babies had been left stranded there. Now, some parents have finally been able to travel to Ukraine, as Jonah Fisher reports.
We're in a minivan travelling through the suburbs of Kiev. The mood is jubilant, because for the Argentine and Spanish couples on board, this is the final leg of a very long journey to parenthood.
I'm feeling joy and happiness. I can't really describe it.
That's Jose Perez. We've been following his efforts and those of his partner Flavia to reach Ukraine throughout quarantine. In May, we helped arrange a video call between the couple in Argentina and their newborn son Manu here in Kiev.
Hello.
Manu was born to a surrogate at the end of March, but much to Jose and Flavia's distress, coronavirus restrictions and the closing of international borders left them unable to pick him up. Manu has been living in a large hotel room, surrounded by dozens of other stranded surrogate babies, cared for by a team of nannies and nurses. Now, with restrictions easing and a generous donor laying on a special flight, Jose and Flavia have made it to the hotel to finally claim their son.
Little Manu has spent all of his life living in this hotel. Now, at last, he's got his parents, and life for this new family can really begin. Just an incredible, incredible moment. Congratulations. This may sound like a silly question, but has it all been worth it?
It's all behind us now. It's in the past. It doesn't matter. Only Manu matters.
Jose and Flavia chose Ukraine because it's one of the few places in the world where commercial surrogacy is legal. A baby costs about $50,000. But the surrogacy industry in Ukraine is largely unregulated and happy endings aren't guaranteed. Four-year-old Bridget was conceived through the same agency as Manu. Nobody is coming to get her. This is the sound of Bridget playing with orphanage staff in the city of Zaporizhia. Born prematurely and with serious health problems, Bridget's American parents refused to take her. Marina Boyko, a nurse at the local children's hospital, has been one of the few constants in Bridget's difficult life.
It shouldn't be a case of, if I like the child, I take them. If I don't, I abandon them. It's utterly wrong. I really hope Bridget will find a family who will love her and take care of her.
At the clinic where Jose and Flavia celebrated receiving Manu, I asked Albert Tochilovsky, the owner, about Bridget.
Do you feel responsible for what has happened to Bridget? Because she's in an awful situation.
Well, we insisted that the parents take her. Believe me, we really tried to convince them. But the delivery went wrong. I do feel somewhat responsible, but from a legal point of view, there is no fault there at all. Maybe I should have done more to convince the parents.
Though 10 other babies were collected on the same day as Manu, there are still more than 60 of them stranded in the hotel room. Forced into the spotlight by the coronavirus crisis, Ukraine's baby business brings both smiles and sadness.
Jonah Fisher reporting. Still to come in the podcast, the Queen learns to zoom.
Interesting listening to all your tales and stories, and I'm very impressed by what you have achieved already. So I'm very glad to have been able to join you today.
Now back to events in the US, and following the killing of George Floyd, there is intense pressure for reform of policing. But will it happen? Roz Atkins considers the obstacles standing in the way.
George Floyd's brother could not have been clearer when he addressed Congress.
Honor George and make the necessary changes that make law enforcement the solution and not the problem.
But while his plea echoed many thousands of others, as one Washington Post headline put it, protesters hope this is a moment of reckoning for American policing. Experts say, not so fast. The article quotes Lorenzo Boyd from the University of New Haven. He says, "We have 400 years of history of policing that tell me things tend not to change. And at the heart of this is the use of force by US police. We saw it in that horrific video of George Floyd. And since then, we've seen it time and time again during the protests. US policing is violent. Statistics show you're 6 times more likely to die in police custody in the US than in the UK, and twice as likely as in Australia. And we know that violence is disproportionately directed at African Americans. So what can be done? Well, you can try and stop certain types of policing. For example, chokeholds are banned in New York, San Francisco, LA, and now in Minneapolis too. But rules are set locally, so a nationwide shift is harder to deliver. You need accountability. Al Sharpton turned to this in his eulogy at George Floyd's funeral.
Till the law is upheld and people know they will go to jail, they're going to keep doing it because they're protected by wickedness in high places.
Now, of course, not everyone would categorize it quite like that, but there's widespread agreement that police accountability is needed. The problem is, police forces have long resisted increased oversight, which brings us to police culture. Some argue there's no issue here. For those who see it differently, well, Minneapolis is taking the nuclear option.
Our commitment is to end our city's toxic relationship with the Minneapolis Police Department, to end policing as we know it, and to recreate systems of public safety that actually keep us safe.
Others want to defund the police, arguing that the root causes of crime are better addressed by shifting police money into social services. But Joe Biden doesn't agree. He says if he becomes president, he'll increase police funding, but with more strings attached.
No, I don't support defunding the police. I support conditioning federal aid to police based on whether or not they meet certain basic standards of decency and honorableness.
Well, maybe those strings will work, but powerful people within U.S. policing don't see a problem with its culture. This is a senior union leader in New York.
Stop treating us like animals and thugs and start treating us with some respect.
Next, there's the militarization of the police. U.S. forces have billions of dollars worth of military equipment. We've seen that on the streets in the last 2 weeks. But America is an armed society. The majority of those killed by U.S. police are armed. Any demilitarization of U.S. police surely requires a huge shift in gun laws, and there's no sign of that. And then there's the president.
Sometimes you'll see some horrible things like we witnessed recently, but 99.9, but let's go with 99% of them are great, great people, and they've done jobs that are record-setting.
President Trump sees himself as a law and order president, and pushing police reform doesn't fit with that. There's one other thing. Americans feel much more favorably towards the Black Lives Matter movement than they did even 2 weeks ago. When public opinion shifts that sharply, all sorts of political possibilities open up. But when I looked at that data around public opinion, I thought of Al Sharpton telling George Floyd's family at the funeral this week. He said, "I'll be here when the TV trucks have gone." His point being, America is paying attention to racial injustice right now. Perhaps the biggest challenge for those demanding reform is to keep it that way.
Ros Atkins. Governors of all 36 of Nigeria's states have joined together to declare a state of emergency to combat rape in the country. In a statement at a virtual meeting, the governors strongly condemned all forms of violence against women and children and said they were committed to ensuring offenders face the maximum weight of the law. From Abuja, Chris Iwoko reports.
The governors say they are pushing for the highest form of punishment under Nigerian law for rapists when caught. The chairman of the Governors Forum, Mr. Kayode Fayemi, said they have asked Nigerian police force to provide a detailed report on the action taken to strengthen their response to sexual and gender-based violence. The governors have also committed to increasing funding to tackle the problem, and a sex offenders register in each state will be created. There are concerns that gender-based violence increased during lockdowns brought in to prevent the spread of coronavirus in the country. In the past 2 weeks, protests have taken place across the country and on social media calling for justice for rape victims. Prosecution levels for rape remain low, and stigma often prevents victims from reporting incidents.
Chris Iwoko in Nigeria. Another of Europe's biggest football leagues, La Liga in Spain, has restarted 3 months after it was suspended because of the coronavirus. Germany's Bundesliga got back up and running last month, while the top leagues in England and Italy resume next week. Guy Hedgko reports from Madrid.
Sevilla and Betis, both from the southern city of Seville, traditionally have one of the fiercest rivalries in Spanish football. But with their passionate fans not able to watch the game inside Sevilla's Sánchez-Pizjuán stadium, they instead had to follow it either on television at home or in the city's bars while maintaining social distancing. In order to make up for the lack of atmosphere, computerised images of fans were projected onto the stadium's seats for television viewers, while recorded chants and crowd noise were played throughout the game. A minute's silence was held before the kick-off at 10 p.m. local time in memory of the more than 27,000 Spaniards who have been killed by coronavirus. There have been concerns that with Spain's football season being extended well into July this year, temperatures inside stadiums could be uncomfortable or even dangerous for players. But it was a relatively cool night in Seville for this game.
Guy Hedgeco, and Sevilla won the match 2-0. During this age of lockdown, Zoom has become very familiar to many of us. But now it's emerged that not everyone is free to use the video conferencing service. Zoom suspended the account of a group of US-based Chinese activists the day after they met on the platform to commemorate the Tiananmen Square massacre. The Humanitarian China group said its account was shut down just days after the event, which was attended by about 250 people, including some activists in China itself. Zoom said the account had been closed to comply with local laws. Zhou Fengshuo is the president of Humanitarian China. He told Tim Franks what happened.
The technical part was working according to expectation. Zoom was commercially tested and freely available in China. People who were presenting from China, they were able to log in with just one click. We had the meeting even though most of the speakers were prevented from connecting. But overall, some of them for the first time got to hear from the Tiananmen mothers. And also for the first time, we have this gathering with representatives from Hong Kong Alliance, you know, the group that organize the world famous candlelight vigil every year to commemorate Tiananmen. And from Taiwan too, there's an organization that commemorates Tiananmen every year.
That all worked on May the 31st. And then what happened after that? Am I right in saying that it was a week later you tried to use Zoom again?
I believe not too late, probably maybe even just on the first day after the conference, our account was closed because the coincidence with the arresting of people in China and the increased surveillance on anyone related to Tiananmen in China.
Did Zoom explain to you why they'd closed your account?
No, we never heard from Zoom, even though they gave public statement to journalists. But we never heard from Zoom directly. That's why we came to public, because for 2 days we didn't hear anything.
And am I right in saying that they've reactivated your account now?
They have.
I suppose the odd thing is that Zoom was suspending your account, which is in the United States.
Correct. That's why it's just ridiculous. But I think the positive side is that they admitted that they were doing it for political reasons. And the only place of pressure was from Beijing. That's pretty clear. But on the other hand, it just left so many questions unanswered.
Zhou Fengshuo. Even the British royal family has taken to using video conferencing during the lockdown. On Thursday, Queen Elizabeth took part in her first ever official video call. Joined by her daughter, Princess Anne, she spoke directly to four young carers in Britain.
Interesting listening to all your tales and stories, and I'm very impressed by what you have achieved already. So I'm very glad to have been able to join you today.
Well, 17-year-old Amna looks after her mum, takes her to doctor's appointments, does shopping and gives her medicine. She was on the call with the Queen.
Well, it was just amazing. The Queen, she was just so invested and she was just such a great listener. And I could tell when I was talking to her that she really, really cared. And her daughter as well. They were just so amazing. So they actually asked me about school and how it's been, it being at home during this pandemic with my mum and my family. And she also just asked how I was in general. She was just such a caring and affectionate person. And it was just absolutely amazing to have the privilege to talk to her. I know that someone like the Queen herself and her daughter actually wanted to spread awareness and help charities and people get their message across. And they recognise those carers, even if they don't recognise themselves. I was just in my living room, just literally trying to like rest for a little bit, and then I get a call out of nowhere, and I was just in shock. I didn't know what to feel.
Amna on Zooming with the Queen. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.
By listening first, strategizing second, and collaborating constantly, MetLife Investment Management takes a client-first approach to institutional investing. With expertise in public fixed income, private capital, and real estate, we are institutional, but far from typical. Learn more at MetLife.com/institutional. That's MetLife.com/institutional.